President Obama is weighing what's next for the war effort in Afghanistan. Our senior news analyst Daniel Shore is weighing what it means for the president.
The president's problem, as one observer put it, is that he has to commit money and manpower he doesn't have to prop up an Afghan leader he doesn't believe in pursuit of a goal he hasn't defined. The president may have thought he could buy time for contemplation by scheduling a series of 5 private sessions with his national security team. But he got some transparency he didn't want when someone, probably military, leaked to the Washington Post the 66-page report of General Stanley McChrystal. That report warned of disaster in Afghanistan in the absence of more troops and a more comprehensive strategy. McChrystal then made his point in a public address in London and was summoned to Copenhagen for what must have been a tense 25-minute meeting with the president. This will not be a Truman-MacArthur confrontation. McChrystal has said he will abide by the president's decision. But he's already had his effect. The uniformed military is concerned about the safety of troops spread too thin. The internal debate at the moment appears to center on 2 opposing concepts, counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. Counterterrorism is counterinsurgency light. It concentrates on going after al-Qaeda and emphasizes air operations. Counterinsurgency aims to rid Afghanistan of Taliban control and to protect the population, a big operation. One decision has apparently been made. The United States is not pulling out of Afghanistan or making any substantial reduction in force. After that, the administration is caught between those like Senator John McCain, who want a build-up for a surge, and those like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who want fewer American troops in Afghanistan. Sooner or later, the White House will have to produce some objectives and some numbers. Then the public debate starts, a debate that may be the most daunting test of Mr. Obama's presidency so far. This is Daniel Shore.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Araya is a movie that has long existed more as rumor than as fact. In 1959, at the Cannes Film Festival, it went up against movies that are now classics, movies such as The 400 Blows and Hiroshima, Mon Amour. Araya still won 2 prizes, but since then, it's rarely been seen. Now, a restored version is opening in theaters and coming out on DVD, as Howie Moshevitz of Colorado Public Radio reports.
Araya has been hailed for its influence on international cinema in general and Latin American and documentary film in particular. But director Margot Benacerraf says it's not exactly a documentary.
Araya intends or pretends to be more than a documentary. I shot a film like a fiction film. And I tried a poetic mood to explain and to involve people in the lives of these people of Raya.
The film is about 3 of the many families who mine for salt on a stark, treeless peninsula on the northeast coast of Venezuela. Men shovel the salt into large baskets, carry them on their heads to the top of a huge pile, dump them, and return for more. Benacerraf scripted the film, but the characters were played by local salt miners who'd never acted in a movie before. With cinematographer Giuseppe Nasoli, Benacerraf filmed Araya in a high-contrast black and white to create startling relationships between the sun, the sea, the land, and the characters.
I could have worked with color, but I didn't want because I said black and white makes images stronger. Dramatizing, making more dramatic the story I was telling, underlining, making a counterpoint between nature and man.
Benacerraf also stylized the sounds. She says that a soundtrack can be like an adjective to the visuals. It can take the audience deep inside the image, as it does in a scene at a seaside cemetery. Benacerraf took sea and wind sounds, played them backwards, and then mixed them. The movie's complex blend of documentary and experimental film caught the eyes and ears of the judges at the 1959 Cannes Film Festival, says film scholar Margarita de la Vega Hurtado.
Her film is really a very good point that hinges between the lyrical documentary, if we can call it that way, and the social movement, the social revolution that will come into Latin American cinema a little bit after her work. When it came out in Cannes, the French and the British and later on in the United States, critics recognized the film as that kind of fusion between the beautiful form and the experimenting of aesthetics with a real search for human beings and for the social meaning of life and interaction between man and nature, man and work. And by man, I mean human beings, I don't mean just men.
This fusion of beauty and social awareness prompted Dennis Doros of Milestone Films to take up the laborious task of restoring and distributing the film.
Because I'm also the archivist on the film sometimes, I see a film 100, 150 times before the end of distribution. And you have to be able to realize that you're going to be looking at this film frame by frame, literally, over the course of months. And that is a primary consideration when we're looking at a film for the first time. Am I going to be able to watch it 400 times? And this was an easy one to do it with.
Some of the most striking shots in Araya show cranes and bulldozers taking over the work from the salt miners. Margot Benicera filmed an aged woman making pottery, but in an ancient way without a potter's wheel. For Benicerov, the experience of filming in the town highlighted the abrupt transition from a medieval world to a modern one that has taken place all over Latin America.
We Latin Americans jump from one century, 16th century, to the 20th century without evolution. We just had this shock, confrontation. And my question at the end of the film is, what's going to happen with that human people? Is there going to be a better life for them? And I let that question in the air. What is going to happen?
Margot Benicerov never made another movie after Araya. She went on to head a number of film and cultural organizations in Venezuela. She returned to the peninsula a few years ago and says she found a ghost town. A few former residents had moved to a nearby village. She says they were simply waiting to die. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
Another official in President Obama's administration is facing strong criticism from conservatives. Kevin Jennings works for the Department of Education. He's head of the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, and conservatives have accused him of being a radical. NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
The controversy started a month after Kevin Jennings was appointed to the senior staff of Education Secretary Arne Duncan. Jennings helps develop anti-drug and anti-violence policies for schools. Jennings' bio touts his 2 decades of experience in the fields of education and civil rights. It also notes his founding of GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, which fights against discrimination based on sexual orientation in schools. It was a conservative family research council that first launched a campaign against Jennings, says senior fellow Peter Sprigg.
President Obama has named probably 3 dozen openly gay people to his administration, and we haven't responded to any of them the way we have to Kevin Jennings. He has a uniquely extreme and radical record in our opinion.
Sprigg cites many issues with Jennings, from Jennings' failure to forcefully disavow past drug use to his handling of a 1988 conversation with a high school student. In one of his 6 books, Jennings wrote that the male student reported going home with a man he met in a bus station bathroom. Jennings told the student he hoped the teen had used a condom. Again, Peter Sprigg.
He didn't tell the boy that maybe he shouldn't be having sex at age 15. He didn't tell him that maybe he shouldn't be seeking sex partners in the bus station restroom. And he should have understood, even though he was a young teacher, that just wearing a condom was not enough to protect a boy in this kind of situation.
I want him fired. I think he's inappropriate.
Sean Hannity at Fox News is among those in the media who have joined the Family Research Council's anti-Jennings campaign. The Education Department refused to make Jennings available for an interview. But organizations like Media Matters, which spokesman Chris Harris says corrects what it calls conservative misinformation, are defending Jennings.
Contrary to what they're claiming, the adolescent who asked him for advice was not 15, he was 16, which is and was the age of consent in Massachusetts. And Jennings himself has admitted that this happened 21 years ago, and he should have handled it differently, and he should have consulted legal and medical authorities.
The student in question issued a statement to Media Matters praising Jennings. Over at the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, the organization Jennings founded in 1990, Executive Director Eliza Byard vehemently defends his efforts to make schools safe for all students.
It's important that we not allow this kind of dialogue to completely subsume all efforts to do good. How can we expect any dedicated people to accept positions in public service if this is what they can expect?
But Media Matters Harris says similar tactics have worked before. Former White House environmental advisor Van Jones stepped down in September after conservatives, including the Family Research Council, attacked him as a leftist who sidestepped the vetting process for White House appointees. The FRC says it will keep targeting other appointees who are, in their words, out of step with the majority of Americans. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences today put the spotlight on ribosomes and on three scientists. Two U.S. citizens and one Israeli have won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has this story on the scientists and their work.
Today started out with a little bad luck for Venki Ramakrishnan. He was bicycling to his job at the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, England.
I came to work late because I had a flat tire, and I was just getting settled in, and the phone rang, and I thought, you know, I have a lot of friends who play practical jokes.
And this had to be one of those elaborate jokes, because the voice said the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences was on the line. That's what you normally hear when you're about to be told you've won the Nobel Prize.
I said, well, you have a very good Swedish accent, but, you know, I have no idea who you are.
Eventually, they convinced him it was for real. Ramakrishnan was sharing the chemistry prize with two other researchers, Ada Yonat of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, and Thomas Stites of Yale University. The prize recognizes their work on ribosomes, the protein-making factories of living cells. Your body contains tens of thousands of different proteins. The recipe for each protein is encoded in the DNA of every cell. What the ribosome does is read the recipe and, like a cook, put together the right chemical pieces to make specific proteins. For a long time, scientists have wanted to understand exactly how this all happens. And for that, they would need to map the exact structure of the ribosome. That's what was done by the three scientists honored with this year's Nobel. They used a technique called X-ray crystallography to map the position of every one of the hundreds of thousands of atoms in a ribosome. This is something that was long thought to be a hopeless dream.
I was skeptical myself.
Thomas Cech is a molecular biologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who won his own Nobel Prize in chemistry 20 years ago. He says it's hard to express just how complex the ribosome is compared to other biochemical structures scientists have studied in the past.
Just imagine someone who had spent their life looking at ditches, and then all of a sudden you get a glimpse of the Grand Canyon.
So he says the three researchers definitely deserved the Nobel. Although Venki Ramakrishnan says it feels strange that the prize he won is just limited to three people.
I mean, science is now done by massive groups of people. Even each of us have, you know, many talented people in our labs who make critical contributions.
One practical application of knowing the ribosome structure is that it could be useful for medicine. Many antibiotics actually kill bacteria by blocking the normal function of the germ's ribosomes. So having the complete structure of the ribosome could help scientists develop new antibiotics. One of this year's Nobel winners, Thomas Stites, actually helped co-found a pharmaceutical company to design alternative antibiotics for drug-resistant infections.
And that is looking like it's going to be very successful.
I asked him how he thought winning the Nobel Prize would change his life.
Well, to be honest, I hope it doesn't.
Do you think you're going to go to work tomorrow?
Absolutely. I have to write a grant application. It's due very shortly.
In fact, he says, working on that application is what he had been planning to do today. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.